This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Tired of not getting a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hello, hello. I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, a show about what's going on in culture and why it doesn't happen by accident. I'm just going to say it. We as a nation have somehow blasted back to 2020. Walk with me. In this year's Super Bowl, we saw Kansas City versus San Francisco again, and just like in 2020, Taylor Swift is dropping albums like hotcakes. And perhaps most eerily, we're looking at another Biden versus Trump showdown come November. Now, the first two things are reasonable enough, but a presidential rematch with the exact same two candidates? You know, for a country that likes to pride itself on marching forward, I can't help feeling like we're stuck in neutral. So to help me wade through this delirious Democratic deja vu, I called up the home team. NPR politics correspondent Danielle Kurtzleben and White House correspondent Franco Ordonez joined the show to answer an important question. Is this election a remake or a sequel? And what does all this mean for Americans who are looking for something new? Danielle, Franco, welcome to It's Been a Minute.
Excited to be here.
Great to be here.
So 2020 is back like it never left. And before we dive into what that says about our culture right now, I want to play a little game with you. How does that sound?
Ooh.
Sure.
The name of the game is Democracy Doubles. I'm going to tell you what one of the candidates said, and you'll have to guess if it was from this campaign or from 2020.
Oh, man.
Yes. No buzzers. Just shout the answers. And you don't win anything except for bragging rights. And the person who gets the most right wins. Okay. So first up, I have one from Biden. And you have to tell me if it's from this race or the last one.
I know the American story. Again and again, I've seen the contest between competing forces and the battle for the soul of our nation. Between those who want to pull America back to the past and those who want to move America into the future.
This one.
I'm going to say 2020.
That could be either one.
Oh, it could. Absolutely.
I'm now thinking Daniel may be right with 2020. I'll go with this one. He definitely talks about the soul of the nation a lot now, but he said the soul of the nation in the previous one before.
Okay. Well, Franco, technically for this specific quote, you are correct. That is from the 2024 State of the Union. But he also talked about the soul of the nation of America, the soul of our country at the DNC in 2020, in his acceptance speech and in the title of a campaign ad. So he did talk about this in 2024, but he also talked about this in 2020.
Kind of seems like the point we're hammering home here.
Well, I got another one for you.
Okay.
Next question. Did former President Trump say this in the lead up to this election or in a past campaign?
We will rout the fake news media, we will drain the swamp, and we will liberate our country from these tyrants and villains once and for all.
2020 or 2024?
I'm going to say 2020.
2024.
You know, I'm going to have to give it to you again. That was Trump this year at a campaign rally in Rock Hill, South Carolina.
I was at that one. God.
Although draining the swamp was definitely core to his campaign in 2016.
Yeah.
And he brought it up again in 2020, which is odd because he had already been in the office at that point for almost 4 years. So he had a lot of time to drain the swamp, but I guess
there's a lot of stuff to drain out. It's a full swamp, you know?
You know, that is actually very close to something that he said in
2020. God. Okay.
Well, that's it for Democracy Doubles. It's a hard game. And by my tally, I have to declare Franco the winner. So the point of this game was to prove that we're hearing a lot of rehashed material as of recent. We've talked a lot on this show, and I've talked a lot in my career about the rehashing of material and culture, how familiarity often wins out over innovation when it comes to what gets seen and what gets made. And I can't help but think about comparing the messages of 2020 and 2024. Are the two of you at all surprised that Donald Trump and Joe Biden are candidates for major parties this year?
I'd say yes and no. I'm definitely not surprised it's Biden, but did not think Trump was going to run. Certainly he was flirting with it, but and then, you know, with all the indictments and the prosecutions,
it didn't seem like this was around the corner at facing 91 felonies. Yeah.
My answer is a lot the same as Franco's. Biden, no, not at all surprised. Now, Trump, we watch this happen in slow motion, so it's hard to say I'm surprised right now. But were you to tell 2022, Danielle, that Trump was going to be the nominee, I would have been surprised.
Both of you are out on the campaign trail. Are people excited about these options? Are they excited about this election?
So if you go to a Trump rally, absolutely. Yeah. The excitement is right in your face. The lines are gigantic. It's quite amazing, the support that he has. Now, you go a mile away from that rally, and I've been to bowling alleys, cafes. It's much different. As you kind of point out, the excitement was not the same. It's a lot more nuanced. If they're Republican, there's a lot of, I'd rather someone else be there. I'd rather it be someone like Nikki Haley. I'd rather it be a new voice, someone who looks more to the future, less backwards. And certainly comes to the Democratic side, I think their motivation in many ways is just to stop Trump. And many of the Republicans, too.
I agree with everything Franco said. There are the super Trump fans. There are the people on the Democratic side who really love Biden and also who just are party activists and are always going to come out. But a lot of the enthusiasm this year, I really think, is going to be negative enthusiasm, enthusiasm against the other candidate. We saw this in 2016. We saw it in 2020 to some degree. And we're going to see it again right now. And it's just a question of whether that is enough enthusiasm to get people out of their houses to vote.
When we sort of pull out a little bit and we look at the polling for both Biden and Trump, I think we can read between the lines and see that there's a clear desire for change from the public. And I can't help but wonder, even though he's already served as president, is Donald Trump more primed to be the candidate of change in this election? Because right now he's not the president. That said, in some states, up to 20 to 30% of voters in the respective Republican primaries are saying that Trump no longer represents the anti-establishment because he himself had become the establishment. I think before he was able to sort of campaign on being the candidate of change who was going to drain the swamp. Mm-hmm. But like, does that still hold up? What's his angle?
If you ask the Trump campaign, they'll say he is still there to drain the swamp. And they'll say that in his first term, that he was working against the establishment when he was in office. Mm-hmm. But this time, now he has 4 years of experience. He knows who are his loyalists. He knows who he can count on. I would say on the flip side, though, he is the establishment. I mean, he has been there 4 years. The House of Representatives went through a whole change of leadership, essentially because of Donald Trump. He's the establishment of the Republican Party.
There is something interesting that we were talking about here about Trump being the head of the party or not. Is he establishment or anti-establishment? He has, at least with his supporters, managed this kind of jujitsu. I go to a lot of Trump rallies. I talk to a lot of Trump voters. And I had a woman this last weekend at a rally. She was telling me Trump is so powerful. He's such a great leader. And also, he's the underdog.
I think he's beaten the odds. And I like an underdog. Although I don't think Trump is an underdog. I think he's definitely the front dog.
So it's like she can manage to hold those things, those two things at once in the same person.
Yeah, and she recognized that that was a contradiction. This wasn't just, she wasn't just spewing nonsense. She was like, he's both, because they see him as fighting for the underdog, but also they see him as wildly powerful, because he is, as Franco was saying, he is wildly powerful. He can kill a piece of legislation without holding elective office right now. That's crazy power.
That is powerful.
But also he's able to tell the world that, no, the world's against me and I'm really not that powerful. Somehow that works. And that is a hell of a message.
I want to go back to like thinking about like the tone of this election, how it's been feeling. One of the wildest things to me is that much like in 2020, this election, I feel as if it's being framed about a referendum on the heart of democracy, about saving the country. And it almost makes me feel delusional that the same two candidates who fought over saving the country back in 2020, who have both served as president since 2016, and yet 73% of Americans, more than ever in the history of this kind of polling, feel like the country is headed in the wrong direction. Why can't a new voice or a new message cut through right now? I just feel like 4 years or 8 years is enough time to have come up with somebody else. And neither party seems to have managed to pull that off.
The first answer that pops into mind is two things. It's a combination of both a relatively evenly matched two parties, Republican and Democrat. Like, no one party reliably blows out the other one, right? Hmm. And besides that, each party sees the other as a threat. And voters see the voters on the other side as a threat to a degree that did not exist 30, 40 years ago. My first presidential election I covered was in 2012. And look, polarization had already taken hold at that point. There were plenty of people who really, really thought Barack Obama was ruining the country. But I don't recall voters then telling me Mitt Romney and his voters are a threat. His voters are terrible, terrible people, and they're crazy. And I don't remember Mitt Romney's voters saying the same thing about Barack Obama. That is very much the attitude. And I'm not trying to be both sidesy here, because one side is peddling conspiracy theories far more than the other side. I mean, that is flat out true right now.
But I wonder, is part of that because ideologically, I feel like they are both closer together, the platform of Obama in 2012 and the platform of Mitt Romney in 2012. Ideologically, they're much closer together toward moderate policies than I would say comparing Biden to Trump's platform.
Oh, yeah. Obamacare was very similar to Romney's healthcare plan in Massachusetts, very much.
Yeah. Right. So, I mean, I feel like that's also a part of it. And as you mentioned, I mean, there's also like some of the theatrics, I feel like, that come with a candidate like Donald Trump that feel like a departure from traditional American politics and politicians.
I think you hit on a very big part there in terms of the question of why can't a new message, a new voice come out. Trump, when he came down that escalator at Trump Tower, and he changed politics in the United States. He changed how we cover politics, nonstop coverage of this one candidate. Mm-hmm. I kind of almost feel like you're not going to get a different kind of conversation until there are different candidates, or until at least Trump moves on. In many ways, one of the key messages from Joe Biden is, you know, don't compare me to the almighty, compare me to the alternative. I mean, he over and over and over wants voters to compare him to Donald Trump. I mean, I think that's Biden's shtick, and I think that's why voters are going to the polls. That's why you had record number of voters vote for Biden in 2020. I mean, it's a cycle.
The two parties have two different reasons why a new voice can't cut through. One is because the Republican Party is the Trump Party now, right? And as long as he is running, as long as he's there, it's, I mean, everybody else is Trumpy, and he's at the center of it. And in the Democratic Party, they're just trying to defeat Trump and sticking with the guy who did it already, and the guy who makes his whole political identity right now defeating Trump, or at least his whole campaign message defeating Trump. And he can say he did it.
And let's be clear. I mean, it is a smart campaign message for Joe Biden. I mean, so often incumbents are, you know, they talk about presidential reelection campaigns or the reelection effort. It's about a referendum on the past 4 years of a president. But this time Biden can say, hey, look, this is a president. You can look at his record. You have a choice here. This is not a referendum election. It's a choice election. So there's some good strategy there from Biden as well.
I hadn't thought about it that way at all. But thinking back to the game we played at the beginning of this conversation, we are still getting a lot of the same messages, though, 4 years later. We've got the same candidates getting a lot of the same messaging. Going back to some of the cultural touch points I was talking about earlier, like, is this a remake or is it a sequel?
I'd say sequel. It's not a remake. Even if this is a very similar election message-wise, the game board is just so different. First of all, plenty of Americans are going to remember the riots, the attacks on the Capitol on January 6th, and the outcome of that. And relatedly, seeing Trump be indicted four times. I mean, we do have polling that shows that were Trump convicted of a crime, there's a good number of his voters who would not want to vote for him again. And that is very, very different from 2020. But in sequel form, everything is ratcheted up. It's, you know, not to be glib about this, but I mean, like, it's, you know, it's the way that the Fast and the Furious gets sillier and more ridiculous and bigger and more bonkers. Likewise, this is bigger, and it's not sillier, but it's bigger.
I absolutely agree with Danielle's last point. She basically ripped it from me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Where this is a sequel. It is a sequel, but it's like now you have your two main characters. They're older, they're a little slower, so they have to ratchet up the drama in order to bring people in and to grab their attention. And I think you're seeing it from both sides. But particularly from Trump, who's saying, look, we're going to go back to the policies of 4 years ago, but we're going to ratchet them up like quite a bit. You know, biggest deportation effort in America. Biden's again talking about like this, the democracy is at stake. And look, every single election is the most important election there ever was. I mean, how many times have we heard that one?
Every single election that I have every been single able to election, vote in. Yes.
And they're, you know, turning it up again, just like before.
Well, Danielle, Franco, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Brittany.
Oh, yeah, this is great.
Thanks again to Danielle Kurtzleben and Franco Ordonez. Coming up, we're digging into a novel that takes place in the middle of, you guessed it, a presidential campaign. It digs into how faith works in politics.
Support for NPR and the following message come from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Here's a familiar situation. You have a question about your credit card. You call the number for help and can't get a hold of anyone. If only you had a Discover card. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. A real person. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy.
Next up, we're taking it even further back to 2007, when flip phones were still in everyone's pockets. Rihanna's Umbrella was playing on the radio. And a relatively unknown Illinois senator announced his candidacy for president. You know the one.
So let me be clear.
It's this campaign and this time period that inspired New Yorker critic Vincent Cunningham's new debut novel. It's called Great Expectations. And yep, that is a crib from Charles Dickens.
Great Expectations is about a young man. His name is David Hammond. And he has kind of stumbled into the middle of a world historic event, namely a presidential campaign. But really, the book is a coming-of-age story.
And Vincent, he remembers that time period and that candidacy particularly well.
I should say at the outset that I, as a young man of 22 and 23 years old, worked for the first Obama campaign. So some of this experience, though not all of what comes in the book, some of it, though, is certainly drawn from my experience.
In my opinion, Vincent has written a great American novel, and I don't say that lightly. It has so much to say about the optimism of that time, American politics as a sort of religion, and what it means to search for something to believe in. I sat down with Vincent to get into all that and why faith in politics feels so far away in today's world. Vincent, welcome to It's Been a Minute.
Brittany, how you doing? Thank you so much for having me. This is great.
I am so thrilled to be able to talk to you about this book.
Oh, man. Thank you so much.
The time period that the story is set in, 2007, 2008, it's this very specific period in American history. But I was also in my early 20s back then.
Yeah.
And so much of what you described felt so familiar. Just even the energy of that time. What were things about that time that you remember feeling that you really wanted to get across to the reader?
Sure, sure. The book begins with David Hammond watching the senator give the speech that would inaugurate his candidacy.
Right.
And this candidate, just as Obama did, chooses to make that speech where Abraham Lincoln gave the same kind of speech.
In the shadow of the old state capitol, where Lincoln once called on a house divided to stand together, I stand before you today to announce my candidacy for president of the United States of America.
To say, you know, here I am, a black man, standing in the same place that the president who freed the slaves stood. Electing me would be an event of similar symbolic significance. Hope and change was the cliche that came over and over from the campaign. But
oh, yes.
This idea of America almost as a literary text, with passages that felt inevitable, that certain strands that started in the 19th century could culminate now, right? That you could have a narrative complete itself through the figure of one person, right?
Mm. The resolution of a narrative. Say more about what you mean by that.
He would talk about Lincoln in this way that made you think about emancipation and think about how it might culminate in a black president. He would talk a lot about King and how perhaps the dream of Dr. King, as they talked about it when we were kids, you know, the dream of Dr. King could be resolved in him.
I chose to run in this election at this moment because of what Dr. King called the fierce urgency of now.
You know, he was very deft at creating these correspondences between the present moment and the past of the country. One of the jobs of a novel is to manage symbols in this way too, right? You're trying to create correspondences, things that like ring like bells all across the text. And so it was interesting to try to do that around a figure who had done that in real life.
Something that I recall from that time is like a sort of wild optimism that so many people held. How is that manic optimism unique to that period?
Well, you know, I've tried to think about this a lot. There was so much reason not to hope in the very beginning of this century with the Iraq War abroad, and certainly for me at least, Katrina at home, that said the world is not right.
Yeah.
And so to have a figure who, you know, had stood against the Iraq War, was sort of a moral voice vis-a-vis Katrina, I think it was still possible to believe at this moment, at least for people of my age, that somebody could resolve things, could on some level atone for things. I think I wrote this partially to look back and find the sources of those hopes. Maybe it was just because I was young, you know, maybe it was just because I was in my 20s. But it wasn't just me.
No, it wasn't just you.
There were people older than us who felt that too. And I think it's maybe it's something about carrying around the weight of a country that has done so much that needs to be accounted for. When somebody comes along that makes you think you might finally feel better about those things, I think that's a seductive thing to accept and go with.
It's interesting because I remember feeling a lot of optimism, but also that even that optimism in and of itself, it took me a journey to get there. Similarly to David in the first chapter of Great Expectations, when he sees the candidate announce his candidacy on the steps of the Illinois State House, David comes away thinking, I can't say that I thought he would win. And I'll be honest, I didn't think that in my real life about Barack Obama for quite a while.
Yeah.
I'll say, I just never thought a black man was going to be president in my own lifetime. It felt like to me as a young person, like, oh, if something happened before my eyes that I never imagined would happen in my lifetime. So what else is possible?
What else is possible?
And it's addictive, I think, to kind of feel that to a certain extent.
Yeah. But to see it happen was like a true mental transformation. I totally agree.
Yeah. It makes me think about one of the things that's really central to Great Expectations. David's desire to believe in something.
Yeah.
You know, he grew up in a strongly religious household, but, you know, he wavered in and out of belief starting in college. And during the story, he redirects some of his desire to believe into his job in politics. Like, while I think all humans, or at least most, the overwhelming majority, search for something to believe in, Great Expectations also looks at near religious belief as a central force of American politics. How is belief baked into the American political landscape?
I think, as someone who was raised just like David Hammond, I was raised in a religious environment. Mm-hmm. I was taught to read scripturally. The way that you address a bit of scriptural literature is you're using all of your powers of metaphor, foreshadowing, reading something in the Old Testament, and looking how it might ring forward and culminate in Christ or something like that. I think that that is deeply embedded in American political thinking, because I think of the way, especially since we're such a textual nation, it's like how the Declaration and the Constitution then come along and ring again in, let's say, the Gettysburg Address, how Lincoln almost rewrites the Declaration of Independence, how then King's speeches reach back to those former sources. This has been a nation of a kind of scriptural interpretation of our founding documents. Hmm. This kind of reading, I think, is, to me at least, important to how America sees itself moving forward.
Coming up, the role of fathers in Great Expectations and in our political fantasies. Stick around.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch. This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who switch could save hundreds on car insurance. Get your quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares why Betterment believes cash can be a strategic choice.
There are times when the market is volatile, when customers are a little nervous about investing. We came to understand that there was an opportunity to introduce cash as part of an investing strategy and to give back yields to the customer.
Learn more about high-yield cash accounts at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance not guaranteed. Cash reserve offered through Betterment LLC and Betterment Securities. Betterment is not a bank. Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares why accessibility is central to Betterment's mission.
The real innovation for Betterment was taking a set of tools that were used by the ultra wealthy and making them accessible to the average investor. And that includes tax strategies, that includes dollar cost averaging. These are all sort of tricks of the trade.
Learn more about automated investing technology at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
Fathers are all over this book. I've been very interested in like the fatherness of it all. David's complicated relationships to the father that is God, mm-hmm. the fathers of the nation, the senator as a father figure, his own father, himself as a father. In so many ways, this book feels like an examination of the patriarch, like the simultaneous love and hatred for the patriarch. I wonder how you see all of that as being related to politics.
Yeah, our various ways of looking up and how those things are gendered. First of all, super dangerous. It leads to statements like, you know, what we really need is a strong leader, which is like the beginning of all political evil, right? And it's partially to, I guess Donald Trump said it this way, only I can fix it. Obama, through different symbolic or implicit means, said something similarly about like my inherent identity can help move us into a new passage in American life or whatever. Both, I think, being like very, not male essentially, but male rhetorically ways of saying, basically kick back and let me take the wheel. Really anti-political statements, really, that say you don't have to worry anymore. A certain kind of male charisma says, pats you on the head and says, I'll take it from here. Thank you so much.
It's like a desire for paternalism.
Yeah. Did you ever, when you were a kid, watch the cartoon? It was called Wait Till Your Father Gets Home.
That sounds so familiar.
Wait till your father gets. Until your father gets.
Wait till your father gets home.
But it was like this, some like harried white housewife being like, your dad's going to get home and apply the belt to you or whatever. And I feel like, you know, America's it's sometimes that cartoon. Like that's what the election cycles are like. It's like, dad's finally going to get home. He's going to set this all right.
I mean, I see so much of that messaging, I feel like.
Yeah. It is like sort of to kind of double back to this religious framing. It's also very messianic in quality. It's like, no, the one is out there. This isn't some of the frustration with Biden right now. By you clinging on, we're forestalling or delaying the arrival of the one.
I want to read a line from David to you.
Oh, thank you.
Perhaps you know it.
I might, even though I feel like I blacked out several times while writing this book. But let's try.
All right. David says at one point in this book, I was made to feel most at home amid excruciating cognitive dissonance, the kind that never resolved. I believed and didn't believe and felt the strain. That really resonated with my team and with me. And it feels like one of the most apt descriptions of what it is like to live today, to like see what's happening in Gaza or living through the continuation of the COVID-19 pandemic, you know, believing that a better world is possible, but like faltering in that belief constantly, like that excruciating cognitive dissonance is every day.
That's right. It's a political reality. You know, you can watch the excruciating images coming out of Gaza and then go to some cocktail party. It goes on and on. I mean, that quote comes from a part of the book where he's talking specifically about his upbringing and how someone could say something awful about a gay person over the pulpit, but then every person in the choir that's going to sing right after this horrible sermon, several of those people are obviously gay. That we can say we believe this, but then this other thing is right there under the crust. And you're supposed to keep a double mind or a sort of compartmentalized mind about rhetorical reality and actual reality, or political reality and personal reality. The more ludicrous and more sort of surreal those distances become, I think the more that mental strain also becomes. You end up not being able to articulate things that you know about life. They haven't been spoken before.
I've had that experience where something is happening and you know that it's real, but it runs so counter to something that you've been told to believe or something that you've been taught that you can't even find the language express the truth of a given situation, because it's just like, it might as well be on two separate planets.
That's right. Maybe one way to sort of define growing up is to finally develop a private language that can accommodate more reality. That can accommodate more of what you actually feel as opposed to what you hear from without.
I love that private language. I love that. You know, I can't help but think about where belief fits into politics today. For many Americans, it feels like the kind of faith that you talk about in this book, corresponding with the Obama era, that kind of faith feels so far away, I feel like, right now for many people. Why do you think that is?
The sort of tragicomic reality of that moment of hope is that right at the moment that Obama is elected is also basically right when the financial crisis starts, right? Toward the end of the book and toward the end of the campaign, this happens. The hope immediately sort of reached a crest and started to cascade. Having lost so many faith in so many institutions, the rise of mass movements, whether it be Occupy Wall Street or Black Lives Matter, or in the last two or three years, a really, for me, heartening revival of the labor movement. Maybe it means that, okay, we've displaced that faith and placed it in each other.
I mean, and that's also like a very obvious foil for that father figure, like for that paternalism. Like, you can't desire one leader if you are focused on spreading and multiplying your faith among the people around you.
That's right. Yeah. It's such a paradox that, like, even though Obama in our minds still has this, if, like you mentioned, if you go back to that time, the word that comes up in connection with him is hope. It might just be that his emergence, like the perfectly charismatic presidential candidate, the person who symbolized so much that mattered to us, maybe he was the end of the charismatic presidency. Maybe the disillusionment that followed that experience has finally taught us that no election is actually going to be the epical moment. All through my life, every election has been the most important one ever. And like, yes. My body does not respond to that signal anymore.
Well, Vincent.
Brittany.
I have really enjoyed talking about this book.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again to Vincent Cunningham. His book, Great Expectations, is out this week, and you can find his other work at The New Yorker.
Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Brittany. This is Jess from Michigan. Have you seen all this drama about Kate Middleton? There was this doctored photo, and she hasn't been seen in months. What do you think is going on?
Jess from Michigan, thank you so much for calling in with this question. I have been thinking about this all week, and let me tell you, I do not care about the royal family, but right now, I am so locked in to what is going on, or what's not going on, I don't know, with Kate Middleton. For those of you who somehow do not know, a few months ago, it was announced by The Crown that Kate Middleton was going in for some abdominal surgery and that she would be recovering, but she has not been seen in public since then. And it's got people wondering, like, okay, was it your surgery? Are you really ill? Like, has Kate Middleton decided that she's done with her marriage to Prince William? For some added context, around the same time that it was announced that Kate Middleton was having surgery, it was also announced that King Charles had been diagnosed with cancer and he was undergoing treatment. And the thing is that since King Charles's illness has been announced, he's had some proof of life appearances that let us know that he's out there somewhere. But Kate Middleton, we haven't seen this woman. Not only have we not seen her, The Crown has been doing some really strange things. On UK Mother's Day, The Crown released a so-called official photo of Princess Kate with her three children. Now, the kids look cute and they're in a photo with their mom and they're smiling. But when you look at Kate, you noticed a few things. Number one, no ring. No ring. Kind of sus. The other thing that many other people have noticed is that the photo itself appeared to be doctored. There are some people that are saying that the smile and visage of Kate in that Mother's Day photo are a match from a past cover of Vogue magazine. America, the UK, and it seemed like the entire world was not buying that Mother's Day photo of Kate. And honestly, neither did the Associated Press, who issued a kill notice for that image, saying, essentially, we don't trust that this is a real image that has been sent out by The Crown. Now, that's kind of wild. The Crown decided to tweet, to get on Twitter and issue some statement saying that, oh, this is Kate, and I'm just a mom who, like many other people, is trying to Photoshop my family photos to make them look their best. I don't know if that was Kate or not. I don't know. I can't say the truth. What I will say is that I find it very suspicious that a 42-year-old woman who has people literally waiting on her hand and foot, I just find it very difficult to believe she would be editing her own photos. Of course, there could be more grave explanations. Like, she could have a serious illness that has her out of commission. And maybe for whatever reason, the palace doesn't feel comfortable sharing that with us. But knowing a lot of the shenanigans that The Crown has been up to over the past, I don't know, 100 years at least, when it comes to their public affairs, something tells me something else could be afoot. I have seen some very compelling conspiracy theories that Kate's absence might signal that she and William are headed for a divorce, that maybe he's getting back together with his rumored side chick from a few years ago. I don't know. Is Kate hiding to pressure William to end the affair? Or, as Oprah may ask, is she hiding or hidden? I can't say. But I'm going to tell you what I absolutely love is the mess and the drama and the intrigue that has all of us riveted. So, Jess, thank you so much for calling in with this question. I don't know what's going on, but just like you and everybody else, I cannot wait to find out. All right, now, one last thing before you go. We are working on some special episodes of NPR's It's Been a Minute, and we want to have you on the show. That is, if you're a member of Gen Z. I'm looking for people ages 18 to 24 to join me for a roundtable. We're going to talk all about the gender divide and how it shows up in dating, your economic outlook, your hopes for the future, and the politics of your peers. If you're interested in coming on the show, email ibam@npr.org. That's ibam@npr.org. Can't wait to hear from you. This episode of It's Been a Minute was produced by
Barton Girdwood,
Alexis Williams,
Liam McBain,
Corey Antonio Rose.
This episode was edited by
Jessica Plachek.
Engineering support came from
Carly Strange,
David Greenberg.
Our executive producer is
Verilyn Williams.
Our VP of programming is
Yolanda Sanguini.
All right, that's all for this episode of It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce. Talk soon.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify, the global commerce platform that helps you sell and show up exactly the way you want to. Customize your online store to your style. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR. Support for NPR and the following message come from Bombas. Bombas makes absurdly soft socks, underwear, and T-shirts. And for every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness. Get 20% off your first purchase at bombas.com/NPR and use code NPR.
What does it mean to be Black in America? In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as Black experiences, you'll hear it means everything. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.